Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It's probably a great understatement to say that the world of work has changed a lot, and the things today on the job are rather different than they were a generation ago. Certainly, it seems to be the case that people work longer hours, that it's more difficult to get away from work. People work at home. People sometimes even end up working on vacation. It seems that our jobs increasingly have come to dominate our lives in the ways that it really didn't do that, perhaps for our parents and maybe even our grandparents. And it makes it increasingly important for people to think about how it is they approach their jobs and do what they can to reduce that level of stress and make it so that the jobs don't completely take over our lives. This morning, we'll be talking with the author of a book who suggests some strategies that you can take to prevent that from happening. Our guest is Sally Helgeson, and we'll be talking about a book that she's written. It's titled Thriving in 24/7, Six Strategies for Taming the New World of Work. It's published by the Free Press. She's written several books, including The Female Advantage, a book dealing with women in management, and also The Web of Inclusion, which deals with leadership. She has talked a lot about the role of work in the new economy. She does a lot of workshops and gives talks and consults for organizations all over the world. She's also written articles that have appeared in magazines like Fortune and Business Week. And she's talking with us by telephone. And as we do that, questions, comments, certainly are welcome. All you need to do, if you want to be a part of the conversation, is pick up the telephone and call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, people are welcome to call. All we ask of callers is people just try to make their comments brief just so we can keep things moving along and accommodate anybody who wants to call. But again, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Ms. Helgeson, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
A pleasure
today.
To be here.
We appreciate it. First, why don't we talk first and with the subject that you deal with in the introductory sections of the book, and talk a little bit about how work has changed.
What I do in the introductory two chapters of the book before I get into the strategies is I try to take a real close look at how our work and our lives have changed over the last decade and a half and the reasons for it. I think this gives people a context for kind of understanding what has happened to them and that it is part of some larger social, demographic, and economic trends. So that's what I try to do in the first part of the book. I look at the way in which work has begun to consume more and more of our lives. It's amusing. One of the facts I uncovered when I was doing the research was that in the mid-60s, Congress, the U.S. Congress, actually suggested that we institute a cabinet-level office on hobbies to help Americans deal with all the leisure time that it was then assumed would result from computers, the introduction of computers into our work and lives.
The Secretary of Hobbies?
Well, we can see what happened. That prediction did not quite come true, and in fact, the technology is so responsible for the invasion of work into what used to be our lives, the fact that work really, for more and more of us, is becoming a 24/7 proposition. One of the things that technology has done is really break down a lot of the barriers between work and home, public and private, men and women, boss and employee, teacher and student, even adult and child, so that our work is much more pervasive in our lives and we don't have the kind of sanctuary that the home used to be. Conversely, and at the same time, a fascinating thing has occurred in that our private and domestic lives have become much more intense at the same time that our work has also become more demanding. Many of us live in very different ways than our parents did, but the differences are kind of subtle. For example, when I was growing up, a family vacation was just, you know, tossing the kids into the car and driving to grandmother's house a couple hundred miles away. And now families plan, middle-class families plan fairly elaborate vacations. They take the kids to every single ballpark in the U.S., on and on, things like that, ski vacations, other things that were a sign of real wealth only 20, 25 years ago are now quite common. So our own lives, you know, we there's a lot in the general national conversation about how intensely kids' lives are scheduled. People live in increasingly far-flung suburbs, which requires a lot of driving on the parts of their parents. So at the same time that our work lives have gotten very demanding due to technology, due to globalization, and due to the fact that organizations are running much more leanly, our personal lives have gotten more demanding and intense as well.
Yeah. It's interesting that how many devices that were billed at some point as labor-saving devices with this idea that this thing will enable you to do the same amount of work or accomplish the same task in less time, thereby freeing up time to do other things. Somehow that never quite works out that way. And in fact, what happens is that, in fact, in the world of work, what has happened is as we get these technologies that we use in our work, and perhaps hand in hand with a lot of downsizing, is that people are the bottom line is that people are expected actually to do more work to produce more. So rather than ending up with more with doing the same amount of work in less time, we're actually expected to do more work, perhaps in the same amount of time, or that the same a smaller number of people is expected to do the work that a larger number of people had done before.
Exactly. And the history of technology has proven that that's a kind of a long-term trend. For example, when the washing machine was introduced, it was assumed that women, who of course were doing the laundry at that point, would spend much, much less time doing the family wash. But in fact, what happened is not that. Women spent the same amount of time doing laundry. It's just that the expectations of how clean people's clothes would be were raised dramatically. Back before washing machines, people tended to wear clothes for a much longer time before they washed them, when washing was much more labor-intensive. And that has tended to be the sort of way technologies have developed. They've raised standards rather than really becoming the labor-saving device that people expected. And it's certainly true. Think of email. You're now expected. It's expected that you'll be in touch with far larger numbers of people than before, when you could only contact them, say, by writing and then later by writing and telephone. You have a much larger and broader network that you're kind of expected to maintain relationships with, and the expectation that people will get back to you instantly has sort of upped the ante there, too. So that's been a constant in the history of technological progress, and because technology has developed so rapidly in the last decade and a half, with dramatic changes, the internet, email, etc., the ante has been up for all of us. And, of course, organizations have used the technological advances often to cut the number of workers, as you point out.
Yeah. Another thing that's really striking, again, it certainly has to do with technology, with email and easily portable computers and cell phones and pagers. And this is probably as true in people's private lives as it is in their work lives, but particularly in their work lives, is there is no longer – it's no longer possible to be – unreachable. Nobody is ever can really be out of touch anymore.
Nobody can be out of touch. It requires people to be in touch. The fact that they are able to be accessed at any time. So that has broken down, as I said, this sort of barrier between what's public, what's private, your own time, your work time, the time you're not working. Those barriers have been breached, and a lot of the way the industrial world was organized was based on the presumption of certain barriers existing socially, demographically, in terms of technology. And because those barriers have broken down by technologies that are ubiquitous, that are easy to carry, and that are very cheap and portable, it has erased a lot of the traditional barriers. At the same time, those technologies have also freed people from the dependence that they used to have on large organizations. to an increasing amount. And that's another theme in the book. And I think that's one of the kind of positive aspects of this technology, is that people are much freer to start something on their own, go out on their own, find ways of working that accommodate them as individuals, as opposed to slotting into large organizations. Peter Drucker made the observation that in a knowledge economy, the balance of power begins to shift away from organizations and towards individuals, because the individuals own the primary means of production. And having cheap portable technologies that people can carry with them so they can do their work wherever they are or wherever they want really intensifies that. So it's, there are big pluses and there are big minuses. The pluses, I think, often have to do with the fact that we're less dependent on organizations. Mm-hmm.
Our guest this morning in this first part of Focus 580, Sally Helgeson, and we are talking about her book, Thriving in 24/7, Six Strategies for Taming the New World of Work, published by the Free Press. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I think that it's the case that now, more than it has been in the past, that people have the opportunity to pursue careers that they find personally fulfilling, that will make the most of their skills, and that are not simply a means of earning a living so you can buy groceries and pay the mortgage payment and put gas in the car and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that probably makes it that more important that then people really get an idea of what is really important to them as they think about how they want to live their lives, both their work lives and their non-work lives. What you say that people should really start with is to go through some kind of an exercise, really get a handle on what you think is important.
Yes, that I think that's more important than it has been, certainly in the history that any of us remember. It's a time in which we need to have a much clearer idea of what's important to us, what our skills are, what our talents are, what our passions are, what we want to pursue. There's so much choice out there in our lives, in our personal lives and our work lives. We have so much, there's so much variety, there's so many options. Anybody who really brings some skills to the table has a whole range of ways in which they can seek to work and seek to live. It's sort of about customizing. In the consumer products and services arena, there's a big emphasis on customization, on having products that serve a niche of one. And certainly any of us who've gone to buy a typical item like sneakers, tennis shoes, and found that there are 600 different kinds that suit every possible activity or shape foot that one could imagine, that this has its good sides and its bad sides. The good side is whatever you want is probably out there. The difficult side is it's increasingly hard to find it because there's so much available. And I think that's a good metaphor for both our individual private lives and for our work lives as well. There's just so much variety and choice that you kind of have to do in the same way if you want to go to an athletic shoe store where there's 600 kinds of sneakers and make a choice that's right for you. You have to do a little homework to begin with. You have to know, have a very clear idea of what you want, or you'll spend the entire day in the store and probably come home with three or four pair of sneakers that you never wanted in the first place. And I think it's kind of like that with our lives, too. Because there's so much variety and choice, because we're less tethered to organizations, because we get to some extent, define the terms of our relationships with organizations, and because we're kind of improvising solutions that will work in the years ahead, we're really on a frontier in terms of how our work and private lives are being improvised right now. Because of that almost excessive choice that we have, It is really important to start at the core, and that's sort of the first strategy or principle that I look at in this book, ways in which people can identify and get clearer about what it is they want to do, how they see their role in the world, what they want their contribution to be. And this is not a one-time thing either. It's something you have to kind of keep doing throughout your adult life as the rules change, as more opportunities present themselves, and as unexpected situations arise, which they certainly do in this environment.
We have a caller here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation?
Sounds good.
In Urbana, line number one, right here. Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think I agree with with your author and with you about the fact that we need to keep reassessing because there are so many opportunities out there. And I would like to call your attention to the fact that this is mostly a middle class and above phenomenon. I think for people of color, the options are much smaller, especially people of color who live in our inner cities. So even I believe that all teenagers perhaps even should start thinking about their strengths and their weaknesses, et cetera, et cetera. I think basically what you're talking about is a middle class phenomenon, and I think we ought to be aware of that, that people of color don't have these choices.
I wouldn't categorize that as just people of color. I think it's people who do not have the educational background that gives them the skills that are valued in this economy, and that includes people of color. It includes Caucasians who come from areas that have poor schooling or endemic poverty. You find pockets of that certainly in Appalachia, in Maine, throughout rural areas in the South and the Midwest as well. So I wouldn't characterize it as having to do with people of color. I think that sort of blinds us to the fact that there's a large percentage of people of color in the middle class who skills are indeed in demand and valued.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yes, you're right. There is a large white Caucasian population.
And the black middle class has grown very fast over the last decade. So I would say that it's more a question of education, and that's why addressing educational inequalities in everything from how our public schools are funded through property taxes is an absolute key issue for how we'll make the adaptation. One of the things that I think is interesting...
Do you make those points in your book?
Oh, sure. Of course I do. Yeah, that's made in the book. And some of these ideas were also explored in the book that I did before this called Everyday Revolutionaries, Working Women and the Transformation of American Life. And one of the things I talk about in that book is the fact that we're really on the frontier of this post-industrial economy, or whatever you want to call it, new economy. And just as when we were in the beginning years of the industrial economy, there were tremendous inequities that became magnified by the transition or shift away from an agricultural to an industrial economy, so now have these inequalities become magnified. And we have not, we're just starting. We're at the beginning of making the reforms and being challenged to make the reforms that will bring larger numbers of people from a broader variety of backgrounds into a setting where their skills are valued. That happened. We spent 100 years after the Industrial Revolution making reforms, everything from unions to the 40-hour work week to the welfare state as it existed in the 70s and 80s, that provided a social safety net for people. And as we're transitioning into a different kind of economy, we've abandoned a lot of those traditional safeguards.
Yes, we have. And I just wanted to remind people that they're still needed.
Of course they're needed, but different kinds are needed, ones that are appropriate to this economy. And I think the most important thing to do is look at how we fund education so that larger numbers of people can develop the kinds of skills that will be valued in this economy, that will give them more flexibility, more autonomy, which only result from having skills that are valued.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to return to this idea of, again, maybe for those people who can, this idea that to decide what you want your life to be like, your work life and your non-work life, you need to take some time to think about what really is important to you. And it seems that this may be sometimes one of the most difficult things, particularly if your life is very busy and you are working very hard, spending a lot of time on that, to actually find the time to do this because you're just engaged in coping and trying to get from one day to the next. And there is no time for quiet reflection about, mm-hmm. gee, what really is important to me and what do I want to be doing? How do you make time actually to do that kind of thinking?
Well, it's interesting because we're kind of caught in a paradox here. On one hand, we are being invaded often by a constant to-do list of chores that we seem to be checking off every day, whether they're personal chores, whether they're work-related chores. We seem to have highly scheduled days. And yet, paradoxically, the environment that we're part of requires to really be successful two things: an unusual amount of personal reflection so that you can get clear with your goals. And secondly, and this is another strategy, and we can just touch upon it here, an ability to really create a strong network of support for yourself. And both of those things require a certain amount of time. I think that the worst thing people can do in terms of being able to adapt to, survive in, and really thrive in this environment is to keep their heads down and just say to themselves, as long as I can get through my to-do list today, I'll be okay. That programmed time for reflection, I have lots of strategies that people who I interview, this book is based on interviews. It's not just, six strategies I made up or something like that. I interviewed lots and lots of people who seem to be doing an exceptional job of thriving in this environment. And all of them stressed how important time for reflection was. And there were a lot of strategies that they employed in terms of taking personal inventory, doing that on a regular basis, planning it in at the end of the month, just at the same time that they would review their checkbook. They would review what they accomplished that month, kind of beginning with the end in mind. That sort of thing. Again, jumping a little bit ahead to one of the later strategies, one of the things that I came away with a very strong sense of when I finished this book, finished doing the research for the book, is that so many of us are very concerned with the notion of balancing our lives, finding balance in our lives. That seems to me to be a slightly backward approach. It's a little bit too daunting. What I came to realize is that the important thing is finding a way to balance your days, your individual days, and really achieve a comfort with the notion of doing something that relates to the important aspects of your life every single day, because that's a manageable task to say when you get up in the morning, today I'm going to have a balanced day. I'm going to fulfill what's really important and urgent, but I'm also going to understand that every aspect of my life that's really meaningful to me deserves some attention or some thought today. And if we can do that, we really can. Those balanced days do add up to a balanced way of living. And reflection, thinking about who you are, being serious about questioning your own goals and looking at what talents you need to develop and also what your liabilities are, what's been important to you ever since you were a child, how you saw yourself then. These are all things that really require that we look at them in this environment.
We're at our midpoint here already, and I just want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Sally Helgeson, and she's the author of several books. The one we're talking about here is titled Thriving in 24/7, Six Strategies for Taming the New World of Work. It's published by the Free Press. Her other books include The Web of Inclusion and Everyday Revolutionaries, as well as the business book The Female Advantage. She does a lot of talking on these topics, also consulting. She's written articles in addition for Fortune and Business Week, and she's talking with us by telephone. And if you have questions, comments, you can certainly call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I think that when you go out and you explore the things that give people the most satisfaction from their jobs, autonomy, a sense that they're in control, is real high on the list. And that is people, that is when you look at people and you find people who really love their jobs and really are excited about them and very high on them, you find that's one of the things that is there. And one of the strategies that you talk about here touches on that. And the fact that now we hear more and more that people can some people at least, can look at their own abilities, their skills, their values, what they want to do, and actually create a job, if one doesn't exist, that would satisfy those conditions. Now, some people maybe indeed can do that. Other people can't really do that. I mean, that is, they can't go out and invent a job for themselves. They have a job.
Right.
But then the question is, how is it actually possible to try to take something of that approach to work and apply it to the job that you have?
Well, that's what I try to do in the third strategy, which I call create your own work, even if you stay in your job. And I think the even if you stay in your job part of it is very important. A lot of the sort of dialogue around creating your own work assumes that people will feel comfortable leaving their organization and going out to be an independent contractor or a free agent if they're not finding satisfaction at their job. From having done lots of workshops, given lots of keynotes around the country, and talked to thousands, tens of thousands of people in various kinds of work, I think it's unrealistic to present that sort of either-or strategy to people, so that either you stay stuck in your job, do what your employer tells you, keep your head down, wear the uniform of your organization, and just slog along, or the only alternative to that is leaving the organization completely. One of the things I tried to explore in this strategy was ways in which people could adapt the work that they were doing in their organization to suit their own needs, their temperament, their ways of working, their talents, so that they could experience more autonomy, which leads to more satisfaction, and also more fulfillment, because they could see that the contribution that they were making to their organization was unique. And I give examples of ways in which people have really partnered with their organizations to create either units or divisions or new programs or new approaches in their organizations that really allowed their own talents to flourish. This requires not only the very clear understanding of who you are, what your talents are, what you have to contribute. It also requires an ability to articulate what you have to offer, to market what you have to offer in your organization, to identify who the market in your organization is for the skills that you want to sell. And it also requires you to have a really good understanding of what your organization needs to do, should be doing now, what business they're in, what product or service they're providing, and how their business is going to change in the future, so that you can really find that point of intersection between what you want to offer the world and what your organization needs and can find useful and can derive value from. So I'm trying to look at it not in that either-or context of free agent or cog in the wheel, but looking at lots of examples of how people enabled their work to evolve in the context of their organization in a way that was satisfying for their own skills and kind of were able to, what I call, run their own shop within their organization.
We have someone else to talk with. This is Southeastern Illinois. It's line number 4. We'll go there. Hello?
Yes, I don't know. This may be outside the scope of your work, but what this program here is today, of course, is the intellectually inclined talking to the intellectually inclined. And that may be the audience that you're pointing toward, but it seems to me that a problem in society today, from the agrarian society to the industrial society, there was a great change, but it kept the fact that the majority of people were involved in physical activity.
Right.
So that the physically inclined had a place in the society. But when you move from the industrial activity to the informational activity society, you go in, you leave a lot people, and I'm not talking about intelligence here. I'm talking about not talking about intelligence or lack of it. I'm talking about inclination.
Mm-hmm.
Extremes examples, of course, would be the bookworm and the jock. But I mean, people who are simply, they enjoy physical activity. They dislike intellectual activity. And it seems that as you move into an informational society, Those people are kind of left behind. I mean, their loss of factory jobs sort of leaves those people out in the cold. And
it's
I just throw that up for grabs, and I'll listen to what you might have to say.
Well, I think you're absolutely right in terms of that. There has obviously been a large loss of factory jobs, particularly factory jobs that required the sort of heavy lifting and physical labor. If you walk into a steel plant today, it's more likely to be a mini mill, and much of the heavy lifting is done by robots, and the steel workers, the kind of work the steel workers do is less involved with heavy labor, and that's also true in auto manufacturing and farm equipment across the board. So a lot of the physical labor has gone out. But I don't really agree with your observation that people whose the way they like to work is physical are getting left out of the game. If you look at the rise of a whole tremendous new categories of people who do physical work, from exercise therapists to personal trainers to masseuses to people who work in health clubs, I mean, there is such a dramatic, that's been one of the fastest growing fields over the last two decades. And I would submit that it, you know, people doing very interesting kind of integrated work with chiropractic that's much more physical. And I would submit that that has opened a whole categories of work for people that barely existed 20 or 30 years ago or existed in really small and specialized number for people who want to do more physical kinds of activity. In the same way, there's a huge boom in demand for chefs, as you know, talented chefs. So there's a lot of kind of physical work as you know, there are more restaurants than there ever were. Small cities, I mean, the small city I grew up in basically had a coffee shop and a diner and a cafeteria. And now there are 20 interesting restaurants in that town. So I think that in the service industries, there have been tremendous opportunities that have opened up for people who are more comfortable doing work that draws on the physical rather than the intellectual side, or maybe we could say integrates the physical side with the intellectual side, and that in fact a lot of that kind of work is more satisfying than some of the kind of rote physical labor that characterized factory work in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I think that your point is well taken, but I think that there has been a shift of people doing physical work that has really moved away from the manufacturing sector and more into the services sector.
And I guess I find myself wondering about the basic assumption, and I think that in some ways maybe we all make it. I'm not just singling out the caller, but somehow this assumption that workers of the past were strong but stupid and workers of today are smart but weak. I guess I wonder about that, whether in fact that's really true
It's really been a very difficult adjustment for many areas in this country, the move out of a lot of the heavy manufacturing and the shift, the kind of shift that has occurred in how manufacturing is done. But I would submit that if you did, and I think this goes along with what you're saying, I would submit that that there was a lot of very, you know, a lot of really miserable kinds of experiences, especially in some of the kind of physical labor that's been done in coal mines and even in auto manufacturing. It's very rote to the kind of work that was done. And, you know, part of the complaint and part of the reason that Detroit developed such problems in the 70s is that people on the line had basically no ability to make decision. They couldn't stop the line if they saw a problem. They had no autonomy. And so I think that we often overlook how difficult a lot of the physical labor that was done in late industrial manufacturing was. And that's not to say that it hasn't, you know, that there haven't been terrible, you know, implications sociologically and demographically in terms of the loss of those jobs. But I think we do sometimes have a tendency to romanticize what they involved.
Let's talk with someone else here. This is Champagne, and it's line one.
Hello? Oh,
yes.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm not sure if you can answer it, but you were saying that it's changed from an agricultural to a factory sort of thing. What do you, if you can answer, what do you predict sort of for a futuristic transformation from factory to what?
Well, I was comparing the transition we went through when we moved from an agricultural to an industrial economy, and my comment was that we're now in a transitional stage moving from an industrial economy to an economy that's based more and more on information. In terms of making some kind of prediction, what I believe will happen are two things. First of all, I think that more and more people with a different ranges of skills will be included in the economy in more creative ways. I think that a lot of the kinds of rote jobs that are available now, you know, whether it's working at McDonald's or Burger King or something like that, I think that information and decision-making will become more part of those jobs. They will require more intense training, and that those jobs will be more satisfying and have more opportunities in them than they have today. I think that's still, in a lot of those kinds of service sectors, we're still in a kind of an industrial focus. And I think my general prediction is that I think work will become more customized to meet and reflect the needs of individuals in the years ahead, and that I must say that I'm fairly optimistic on the demise of the late industrial culture. I certainly am not one of these people who feels that manufacturing is going to go away, or that America is going to completely lose out on manufacturing, or it's going to be abandoned to overseas. But I think that in general, we're moving to an environment in which work will become more satisfying for larger numbers of people, more customized to fit their needs. And I think that's essentially the direction we're going in.
Okay. And also, I think you might have already answered this. I don't know. I wasn't here for the beginning part. But you were saying that it's more less service-oriented, and you're saying McDonald's and stuff. In that case, what about... it's just been, I don't know if this is true or, but it's been a notice to me that it seems that more people are becoming less educated. I don't know, that might not be true, but it just seems, and then in that case, how are we going to stimulate what you were talking about with customizing jobs to your own level if people can't operate it?
I don't feel that I have the expertise to say whether I think people are becoming more or less educated. There are indicators going in both directions. It's really hard to make that, and I'm not an educational expert or historian. I do think that our biggest challenge in the years ahead will require is really finding ways to provide a relevant education to the emerging workforce. The way our schools were constituted really was to address the needs of an industrial workforce, and I think that's one of the reasons we're in such a kind of quandary about what an appropriate educational model is at this present time.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I want to introduce again our guest. If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Sally Helgeson. She's a writer and lecturer, has done a lot of consulting for corporations around the world. She's written articles for Fortune and Business Week. She's authored several books, and if you're interested in exploring this topic, the one that we're discussing here, you should look for her most recent book, which is titled Thriving in 24/7, Six Strategies for Taming the New World of Work, published by the Free Press. If you want to call in, join the conversation, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I mean, I don't want to put too fine a point on it or belabor this point, but I guess I still find myself thinking, no matter what, working in fast food is, particularly if you're a line worker, is likely to remain a relatively unstimulating and unsatisfying kind of job. I guess I have a hard time thinking about what could be done to make that more satisfying than it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think of it, it's sort of the industrialization of a lot of service work. And as we've moved, I mean, manufacturing provides lots of interesting kinds of models for integrating a degree of autonomy into line workers' work and changing the possibilities. I mean, we've seen that in some of the innovative factory processes that were introduced, say, at Saturn, at New United Manufacturing Motors, which was an experiment that GM tried very successfully but abandoned out in Oakland, California. So there are numerous manufacturing models for ways in which manufacturing has changed. And I think that will begin to happen in the service sector. And I think it will be driven by the fact that as we find ways to address this educational conundrum, it's going to become more and more difficult for that kind of low-wage service sector to attract people who can do any kind of work at all, and that the dissatisfaction of the people who they employ will drive them to begin to make those kinds of changes.
Let's go to another caller here. Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I would like to make a comment about the subject. This is as old as these problems, as old as the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, and it's always been the worker against the capitalist, and the capitalist getting as much work or the least amount of money, and the working class in general, who have no other source of income in the industrialized economy than to off the farm and into the factory and so forth. And that problem remains and shall remain until we get some sort of revolution that recognizes that workers per se are human. I mean, the fact that remains that the worker is on his own. He has absolutely no method except under capitalist tutoring that you must become an entrepreneur, you must become this or that person in order to compete in the system, which is grossly unfair. And we are now experiencing what England went through some 100 years after their colonial peak, that everything is farmed out. You go and live in your manor house, and you need only servant class again by this time. And shipping out of industrial jobs and all the other things that will accrue capital to a handful of people upon this earth, and everybody else is doomed to play that game and starve or to try to move in the system as it continually changes as capitalism decays. I'll hang up, and thank you for your time.
Okay.
All right. You can comment on that or not, however you like.
Well, I basically disagree with your caller because I believe that the role of capital has become dramatically diminished in our economy as the role of knowledge and information has become ever more important. Capital is not the driving force behind innovation in products and services in our economy today, and control of capital is not it may be centralizing at this particular time. As we see, there's more and more money being driven to the people at the top and less for the people at the bottom, but those are more the results of some of the kind of political and taxation decisions that are being made presently. But I would submit that capital is far less important in the underpinnings of today's economy than knowledge is, and that knowledge is controlled by individuals. I think, obviously, your caller is a sort of classical Marxist in his point of view, and I think that one of the fascinating ironies of the last 15 years or so is that we've seen an interesting twist on Marxian economics as workers, as the people in the ranks, more and more do own the primary means of production, which is knowledge. So I would disagree with that, and I would also argue that we are in a revolution right now in terms of how of the control of the primary means of production, the shift to a knowledge economy. I submit we are in a revolution that is peaceful, although in other more metaphorical ways it's quite bloody at this point because so many people are really losing out on the fruits of this economy.
Well, we'll try to get one more person here. This is Champagne. It's line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, this goes to the question of education, and while I certainly don't discount the importance of training people for work, and this goes to your last question as well, I think one of the things that really gets short shrift in our educational system is teaching citizenship skills, and I think that's just very, very important, and it just permeates our whole culture now. In that, you know, we don't refer to people; we refer to people as consumers when we're talking about the broad public, not as citizens.
Oh, I remember! I remember very clearly listening to George Bush the First one night on television talking about. He spent the entire evening referring to the voters or the citizens as consumers. Absolutely, I agree with you very strongly, and I think that educating people for work, per se, has become less important as we've shifted to a knowledge economy, and would agree that educating people for citizenship and perhaps most importantly of all, educating people to think and think for themselves have become ever more important, that the skills of work can be picked up at the workplace, but training people more broadly to think and to think about what their purpose is and to think about what their role is in our society, our culture, and our nation is more important than it was in the past.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we're coming down to the point here where we have this couple of minutes left, and I know that I think we've hit several of the strategies that we have that I've referred to. They're referred to in the title of the book. Is there any last thing here about a minute and a half you'd like to leave? Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Yes, there is, and I think it relates to the second strategy, which in the book is called "Learn to Zigzag." That is a strategy that really recognizes and advocates that people understand that we have moved past in this economy and environment characterized by rapid change, volatility, and opportunity as well as challenges, that we have moved past the sort of passages approach to life that we thought of in the 70s and 80s, in which the stages of life are really tied to ages. Today we do different things at different times. Our paths, as we've talked about a little bit here, are more individual and more customized. Almost everyone I interviewed for this book started off the interview by saying something to me like, I didn't follow the normal path, or my career didn't unfold in the usual way, or things were very different for me. I took a different approach. And I've come to realize that that's more and more true for more and more of us. Our work lives are more varied. Our private lives are more varied. People who are 26 have midlife crises. People who are 72 start off on new careers. And I would urge people to recognize this and think about the implications for their own lives. I think it's an important strategy to understand.
Well, at that, we will stop with, again, mention that if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, you can look for the book that we have been talking about here. And again, the title, Thriving in 24/7, Six Strategies for Taming the New World of Work. It's published by the Free Press by our guest, Sally Helgeson. And Ms. Helgeson, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure.